Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. The great American statesman Benjamin Franklin said that in the late 18th century, in the founding of these United States. It is even more true here in the beginning of the 21st century. I've talked about many violations of civil liberties that have come in the last 2.5 years since the 9/11 attacks on the United States several times on this show. And so has my guest this morning, a gentleman by the name of Nat Hentoff, who has been writing about civil liberties for, I think, close to a half century now, and who has a new book out called The War on the Bill of Rights and the Gathering Resistance, and I'm happy to have him on the show. Hello, Nat.
Hello.
What is the number one thing in the War on the Bill of Rights, the greatest violation of American constitutional rights that has come up since 9/11?
The greatest violation will be the subject of oral arguments before the United States Supreme Court next month on April 28th. The Supreme Court will hear the government's argument that George W. Bush, and this is unprecedented in American history, has the right, on his own authority, without consulting Congress, and until now his administration has said the courts should have no say in it either, but the court surprised the president by saying, no, we want to hear the arguments, and as a result, before the court will be the case of two American citizens, Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla. Both have been held for nearly 2 years in Navy brigs on American soil without any charges, held incommunicado, held without access to their lawyers until suddenly, so the government could show the Supreme Court a better face, they finally got to see their lawyers, but it didn't work because there was somebody else in the room from the government, and they videotaped the conversation, so there was no lawyer-client confidentiality. The question is, where does Bush get this authority to do what has never been done before to any American citizen, that is, strip him or her of his basic due process rights?
Let me play devil's advocate here for just a second, because I think we're on the same page on a lot of these things. But as the devil's advocate, I got to ask you, if we have people who are working for the terrorists, working for the enemy that wants to try to bring America down, what's wrong with taking them aside and saying, you know what, you don't deserve the rights that every other American deserves?
Because there is nothing in the Constitution or in statutory law that makes that lawful. The Congress, back in 1971, I think, passed a law saying that no American citizen can be, to use the euphemism, detained unless Congress is consulted. The president does not have this authority. Now, in the case of both of these people, how can you say what they're doing if they haven't had a hearing before, if they haven't had a chance to combat whatever evidence, and it's very unclear what that evidence is, that the government has? This is not the American way. This is what you'd expect in Zimbabwe or Cuba or China.
Is this, have they been classified as enemy combatants? And what exactly does that phrase mean?
That's a good question. I asked that question recently of Viet Dinh, D-I-N-H. When he was with the Justice Department, he was the drafter, the principal drafter of the Patriot Act. And I've since got to know him. He has objections. He doesn't have objections to the Patriot Act, although I do. But on this case, I asked him, I said, okay, tell me where in American law the president can say all by himself that this American citizen is in enemy combat, and show it to me. And Viet Dinh honestly said, I can't. I can't show you exactly in American law. That's what the Supreme Court, among other things, is going to have to decide. If the court decides that this president can do this, and considering that this war on the terror by the terrorists is going to continue who knows how long, way past the next election or maybe the election after that.
Way past our lifetimes, let's admit that, Nat. It's going to go on forever.
Oh, yeah, because it's not only Al-Qaeda. There are now splinter groups all over the world. Some of them say they're from Al-Qaeda so they can get recruits easier. But this kind of madness, this hijacking of the Muslim religion or this transmogrification of nationalism is going to be with us because they have the kind of facilities, as you can see, for making bombs and other stuff that they keep on doing.
Has any president in our history changed the law in this way? Didn't Abraham Lincoln say habeas corpus is suspended during the Civil War?
He did more than that. He suspended habeas corpus. He arrested hundreds of people who disagreed with his policies on the Civil War. He put many of them in military tribunals. Then, in 1866, after Lincoln was assassinated, after the war was over, the Supreme Court of the United States, in a case called Ex Parte Milligan, said to Lincoln in absentia, you couldn't do this. This is unconstitutional. While the civilian courts are open, you cannot suspend habeas corpus, which, as you know, is the oldest American-speaking safeguard. If you're in prison, the government has to go to court to prove that you are legally in prison. So what Lincoln did, and I know he's venerated these years, sometimes for good reason, but our history classes are pretty meager these days in the public schools, or private schools for that matter. People don't really know that what happened in the Civil War. So in answer to your question, Lincoln did it, but it was unconstitutional.
Let's talk about the Patriot Act, which is set to expire at the end of 2005 if Congress doesn't act to renew many sections of it. I have railed against the Patriot Act, and I know you have in print and speeches as well. Tell me what you think is the heart of the evil of the Patriot Act.
Boy, there are so many hearts of evil in it, but let's begin with something that no administration has ever had before. And that is the kind of advanced electronic surveillance of us that George Orwell couldn't have even foreseen. Back in 1928, I think the wisest man who ever sat in the Supreme Court, Louis Brandeis, was a dissenter in the first wiretapping case. And he said, you know, eventually, because of the way technology is going, the government is being able to get your secret papers without your ever knowing about it. And this is what's happening. I'll give you an example. Section 215, or better yet, Section 213 of the Patriot Act, the so-called sneak and peek provision, when the FBI can come into your home when you're not there, or your office, look around, look at your hard drive, take what they want, but then insert the magic lantern. It's also called the keystroke jogger. They put it in your computer. And thereafter, whatever you type, whether you send it out or not, they come back when you're not there and download it. So Justice Brandeis was very prescient. But there's so much more than that.
Well, let me just stop you right there, Nat. Under what authority? A court's authority?
Oh, yeah. Unlike the days of J. Edgar Hoover, when the FBI agents would come in and take what they wanted under what were called black bag jobs, they come in with a court order. But according to federal law until now, any time a law enforcement agent comes into your home when you're not there, they have to leave notice so that if they got the wrong address or if your lawyer wants to contest the court order, they can go right to court. Now, they wait 90 days to give a notice, and they may continue that silence indefinitely. They keep going to a court and say, hey, this is part of a national security investigation, so give us more time. And that's one of now let me go back to another part of the Patriot Act, mm-hmm. which I think more people know about than the others,
yep.
because librarians around the country have been creating a lot of attention to it, and they've been resisting it. Section 215 means that the government, pardon me, goes to a secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was set up in 1978. This is a court where only the government appears. There's no lawyer for the other side. All the FBI has to say is, we have a certification from the Attorney General that this is involved with an investigation connected to terrorism. They can then take that court order from the secret court, go to a library or bookstore, and say, here's a list of books that have either been borrowed or bought. We want to know who bought them or who borrowed them. And once the FBI comes under Section 215, the librarian or the bookstore owner cannot tell anybody that they've been there. They can't even call the press.
So if they're investigating me and they find out my personal records of what I bought or what I borrowed from the library, I have no way of knowing that I'm being investigated.
That's right, until if and when they decide to indict you. I've even talked to the law firms that work for the American Library Association and the Booksellers Association, and the lawyers aren't even sure that if you were arrested and then went to court, whether they might seal the court, as they did in the immigration proceedings for quite a while. But there's something else. The librarians have focused on this, but this Section 215 covers much more than library book records. Under this, they can get business records. And again, without any Fourth Amendment guarantee. The Fourth Amendment is the most specific of all our Bill of Rights under the first 10 amendments. It says government has to go to a judge before they can search you or your home or your office or your library records. And they have to show probable cause, which is a strong, guarantee that a crime has been committed or may be committed, and they have to be specific. Who's the person? What are you looking for? Under Section 215 and the secret court, probable cause is not there. It's just we have an investigation going on, and that section covers hospital records, education records, travel records. And that's part of not only the Patriot Act, but what Ashcroft and the government have done since then. On the day that Saddam Hussein was caught, when, of course, the media was concentrating on very little else, the president signed part of a Foreign Intelligence Act, which allows the government to send out national security letters. They, too, encompass vast amounts of personal information from hospital records, doctor's records, travel records, etc., and they don't have to even go to a court to get these national security letter information. Now, from the beginning, right after 9/11, the president, the attorney general, the administration as a whole said, whatever we do in national security is going to be within the bounds of the Constitution, and certainly whatever we do will have judicial supervision. That is less and less the case.
Now, I have talked on this show, Nat, about things like the TIA, the Total Information Awareness Program, and the TIPS program, where people like cable installers would be basically deputized by the government to when they're in your house to look around and see if there's anything suspicious. And there's been a public outcry about some of these things, and I think some of them Congress has said, okay, we're not going to do that. But I also get the feeling that a lot of it has been done, even though we didn't think it was being done. Is that true?
Well, what happened was, in terms of Operation TIPS, there was a strong conservative libertarian, a Republican named Dick Armey, who at the time was in charge of marking up these bills, and he said, I'm not going to allow Americans to spy on each other, and that was killed by Congress. Total Information Awareness System, which allowed all kinds of databases to be converged, not only federal law enforcement databases, foreign databases, commercial databases like the cookies we leave when we go to a website, that was finally stopped in Congress, in part because the man in charge of it, Admiral Poindexter, not admirable, was a man of considerable, suspicious background. He could have been convicted of a number of felonies in the Iran-Contra scandal, but he was let go because he gave testimony. But anyway, that's still going on, the Total Information Awareness System. It's something called Operation Matrix, and it's done by a private firm in Florida that is funded in part by the Defense Department and the FBI, and it is they're selling the kind of equipment, only it's faster now than was available to the Defense Department and Total Information Awareness System. They're selling that to the individual states.
Now, wait a second. Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying here, because I'm shocked at what you just said, and I want to make sure that people understand this. There is a program going on now in the United States called Operation Matrix.
Right.
Which the government can use and private industry can use to see...
No, wait. What they're doing is selling this kind of mechanism, this advanced electronic, to individual states. So state governments can use it. They've signed up now, I think, about 9 states.
So those the state governments can then look through databases of all of our personal information, what we buy, where we shop, where we bank, what medicines we use, and all that sort of information. And I'm sure it's under the auspices of some office that says, well, we have to keep an eye on trends among people.
And that's the whole idea, that they believe that by getting all this information together, they can... Well, it's like what's going on now at airports, what the government is planning in terms of CAPS II, as they call it, where when this hasn't started yet because Congress is beginning to get a little restive about it, but their plan is as soon as you buy a ticket, the airline has to provide an office of the government with your name and address and other basic information to make sure you're who you say you are, then they can tap that information into various databases to find out more. Now, I say Congress is getting suspicious of this because that's one thing that I find encouraging. I don't think ever in American history, when you've had these, like the Red Scare in the 20s, what happened during the First World War when Woodrow Wilson practically abolished the First Amendment, now we have a resistance around the country, both in the grassroots and in Congress, that covers the entire political spectrum. What's been happening around the country, there are groups called Bill of Rights Defense Committees, and it started in Northampton, Massachusetts, early 2002, when a bunch of doctors, social workers, students, teachers, got the city council to pass a resolution telling members of Congress from that area to look at what's going on with the Patriot Act and to do what they can to roll it back. Now there are about 262 towns and cities, 3 state legislatures, Alaska, Hawaii, and Vermont, that have these resolutions, and they're working in that more and more members of Congress are responding to constituents who send them letters and emails about this. And the result is, in this current term of Congress, there are several bipartisan bills to not repeal the Patriot Act, but to make the language a lot clearer and to bring back some of the Bill of Rights. The problem at the moment is that Orrin Hatch, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has yet to hold any hearings because he thinks the Patriot Act is just fine. But these members of Congress are very insistent. And you mentioned before the sunset clause, which means that by December 2005, Congress has to review some of the sections. In his State of the Union address recently, the president urged that Congress not end any of those sections, and there was applause when he mentioned that there was a possibility of ending it, and that applause was not only from Democrats, it was from conservative Libertarian Republicans. And James Sensenbrenner, the very conservative head of the House Judiciary Committee from Wisconsin, said, "Over my dead body, are we going to just rush through a confirmation of all those sections? We're going to have some very careful hearings."
And rushing through, by the way, is a very appropriate phrase for this, because it was signed, it was created and signed very, very quickly after 9/11, when this country was in a panic. And people said, oh, we've got to protect the country. We've got to do whatever it takes to protect the country. Who knows when a horrible attack like this will occur again? And the problem was that most of the people who signed this, most of these weasel politicians who signed on to this, did it blindly, without reading it, but they heard that there was something called the USA Patriot Act. And you give a bill a name like that because the name itself has enough impact. And you can say to somebody, what, you're not a patriot? You won't sign this act?
Well, you know, some of the members of Congress who signed it, who are now very regretful, will admit, and I've talked to some of them, they said, look, elections were coming up. If we don't sign something called the Patriot Act, our opponents are going to say we're soft on terrorism, so they went along.
Yep.
But there's an interesting story about that. In the House Judiciary Committee, they tried to take out some of the worst parts of that act. There was a bipartisan group with, for example, Bonnie Frank on one side and Maxine Waters or Bob Barr on the other, and they got it through. But then late at night at the White House, there was a meeting between members of the administration and the House leadership, and they took that stuff out. So as you said, the next day when there was a vote, it was, I think, a 365-page bill, the revised bill. Most of the members didn't have time to read it. John Conyers, who was the floor leader for the Democrats, said, hey, we only have about four copies even of it.
Nat Hentoff has been writing about civil liberties in this country for nearly a half century. He has a new book out called The War on the Bill of Rights and the Gathering Resistance. He will be here in St. Louis this Sunday at the Washington University School of Law, giving a speech Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, which is open to the public. And we're talking here today about the Patriot Act and other attacks on American civil liberties. Nat, are there documented abuses of the Patriot Act? I recall hearing some story about a strip club, but I don't remember what it was, and I don't know of any others. Can you fill me in?
Well, to begin with, there is so much secrecy involved in implementing it. That's one of the reasons that members of Congress on both sides of the aisle are very angry. They keep asking Ashcroft, we want to know exactly what's going on when people get pulled out of line at an airport, and what kind of information are you gathering on us? What did come out very publicly was the Inspector General of the Justice Department itself, who is independent, he was appointed by Clinton, had a survey of what happened when over 700 non-citizens were rounded up not long after 9/11 on the basis largely of their last names, or what appeared to be their last names, no particular evidence that they were any way connected with terrorism, and none of them was connected in terrorism after many months in prison. And the Inspector General pointed out that there was no legal basis for the length of time they were held and the vagueness of the reasons they were held. Some were really beaten up in at least one of those institutes, you know, one of those prisons, whatever they call them. But since then, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Center for Constitutional Rights, have filed lawsuits alleging real violations of due process of all kinds of people, American citizens and non-American citizens. And I mentioned before what happened to Yasser Hamdi and Jose Padilla, who have been stripped of all their rights. And I think if we can get some of these bills through Congress, like the SAFE Act that Larry Craig, a Republican conservative from Idaho, wants in, and a very important bill by Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, also Republican, which will make them tell us what they're doing. And that's why, you know, the librarians are upset, and Ashcroft said, oh, we haven't used that provision, Section 215. He didn't say that he wouldn't use it, and nonetheless, there have been a number of FBI visits to libraries, but they can't tell, the librarians don't even know what happened as a result of those, and they can't tell anybody about the visits.
Mm-hmm.
So secrecy is, you need a certain amount of secrecy, obviously. You don't want to tip off terrorists, but we're still American citizens. And as Lance Morrow, who is a conservative columnist for Time magazine, wrote some months ago, if we lose the Constitution, we've lost everything.
And that really is the bottom line here, is that these are American citizens whose rights are not being respected. We're not talking about some guy who's a Saudi by way of Afghanistan who came to this country illegally, and the INS should have been keeping an eye on him to begin with, and then they finally catch his scent, and they get on his trail, and they decide, let's wiretap and let's keep an eye on this guy. We're talking about a couple of American citizens who were thrown in the brig for no reason here, and others whose rights should be violated. But I got to tell you, that I think that 99.9% of Americans look at this and say, well, this isn't going to affect me, so why should I care?
I know, I've heard that a lot. And I'll tell you, one of the real problems is the media, whether it's newspapers, radio, except for some of the talk shows, cable or broadcast television. People in my business, and I've been a reporter, as you said, for almost 50 years, have been caught up in a bad treadmill. It's called the 24-hour news cycle. So you hear more than you want to know, more than I want to know anyway, about Kobe Bryant and Michael Jackson and Martha Stewart. But when a story is in that indicates some of what we've been talking about, it dies in 1 or 2 days. And then it may come back again 2 or 3 months later. If the media were simply doing what Thomas Jefferson said the press had to do, which to inform the electorate of what's going on, then more people would realize it. But yet, nonetheless, you've still got, as I mentioned, over 260 towns and cities, some of them from very conservative rural areas, some from college towns and the like. So there is a rising acknowledgement of what's going on. Otherwise, you wouldn't have members of Congress so upset now and maybe doing something about it if they can get a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Let me play devil's advocate here again for just a second. We're in tough times. These are uncertain times. We're not in a war against a leader of a country. We're in a war against people who have no country, who have decided that because of their religious extremism, they just want to take America down because of what it stands for or for whatever their reasons are. And if that's the kind of war we have to fight, our government needs to expand its powers to fight them. What do you say?
It has to do that, and it has to be doing it effectively. The problem is the so-called new culture at the FBI is such, you know, they're supposed to now cooperate with local and state police agencies. I've talked to various police chiefs and agents, and it's still the FBI. They won't tell you anything. But more important than that, there's a lack of real knowledge of how to investigate. One of the key critics of John Ashcroft and the Justice Department has been William Webster, former head of the FBI, former head of the CIA, former appellate circuit court judge. You have to take Jose Padilla, for example. He's arrested in public at O'Hare Airport in Chicago. The attorney general is in Moscow for some reason. He gets on television and says, "We have caught this guy. He's going to work. He's going to make a dirty bomb, but he's a terrible terrorist." First of all, whatever happened to the presumption of innocence? Second, in terms of investigating basic techniques, why didn't they follow him instead of arresting him if they had thought that he had something on him? Then they could have found his contacts. Why is it that the FBI to this day doesn't have enough agents who speak Arabic, don't have enough translators who can read Arabic? That's a dysfunction that has not yet been really addressed by the government.
It sounds to me like the government doesn't need more power. It needs better people.
They need more competent people, and they need to... The point is, you know, years ago I used to cover homicide detective squads, and after a while they began to be glad that there was such a thing as Miranda warnings, because then their cases could hold up. It's interesting to note that most of the so-called convictions that Ashcroft has gotten have resulted in very minor sentences, because this charge of terrorism can't be fully justified. There have been confessions, but you know what they do with confessions increasingly? And defense lawyers have told me this. The government will say to a defendant charged with some kind of connection to terrorism, "You better confess or we're going to make you do to you what we did to Hamdi and Padilla. We're going to take you away, put you in a brig, and you won't be able to talk to your lawyer anymore." That's not justice. That's intimidation.
Yeah, that's draconian is what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the word to describe it. The book is called The War on the Bill of Rights and the Gathering Resistance. Nat Hentoff has been writing about this stuff for a long, long time and is one of the best on the subject. He'll be talking about it in a speech called The Patriot Act, What Price Security, this Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Washington University School of Law here in St. Louis. It's a great pleasure having you on the show,
Thank
Nat.
You, and the book is published by Seven Stories Press and is available on Amazon and places like that.
Terrific. I hope to have you back on in the future. We'll talk more about this.
Thank you.
Nat Hentoff here on The Paul Harris Show. This is the Big 550 KTRS.